Welcome back to Listening to the Dead, Season 2. More crimes, more forensics, more revelations. This is Episode 2, Terrorism and Mass Disaster.
Hello, and welcome back to Series 2 of Listening to the Dead. I'm John Watt, and I'm joined by the Queen of Crime, novelist, producer, and screenplay writer, Linda LaPlante, and former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force, Kaz Sutherland. This is episode 2, and we're talking about terrorism and mass disaster. It is a giant subject, Linda, and a sensitive one, but one that you confronted head-on in your novel Good Friday. What are your memories of plotting and researching that novel, Linda?
Well, basically, I didn't want it to be necessarily a political statement. You know, I wanted to show was what happens when you have the public surrounded by a horror of the bombing and what happens, who saw what. You know, you can interview so many people and they all have a very different take on what occurred. And it was important for me to show you the young detective in it, how she approached it and the shock, because I think the waves when anybody is involved in any form of a disaster, even a flooding in your own house, never mind something blowing up in your own house, there is that panic that happens. What do I do? And so in reality, that was the avenue that I was going on, rather than bringing in the IRA, which of course we did, but fleetingly. And so everything I went by was how you deal with panic. That was my main priority in that.
Yeah, it's like a series of Homeland. It's a really high-octane race against time before the bomb goes off.
Yeah.
Were you wary of using terrorism in a novel?
Yes, very. Because I think as soon as you move into a political area, you have to be very, very careful. And, you know, I learned about the kind of lying low of IRA people in safe houses, how sometimes they were not brought into the fore for maybe years, which was the case in Good Friday. But my priority was dealing with the aftermath.
Yeah. I grew up in the 80s. I can well remember that sense of apprehension in London when the bombing campaign was at its height. Kaz, what was it like working in the police during that period? When did the police get its own division to deal with terrorism?
Well, actually, I had to do a bit of research on that, and I found it quite interesting because it was actually back in 1883. The then Home Secretary, William Harcourt, set up what was then known as the Irish Bureau, became known as the Special Irish Branch. And it basically was 12 detectives. Whose mission was to defeat what was known as the Fenian terrorist campaign that was going on in London and across the country at the time. But then as the years progressed, I think it was around 1964, the Met formed what was then known as the Bomb Squad. And their actual remit was to deal with safecrackers, guys who used explosives to gain entry into safes. But then when the IRA sort of started its bombing campaign in the 70s, it then sort of basically dealt with that and devoted most of its time to and resources to investigating the terrorist threat from the IRA. Then I think it was 1971, Bomb Squad became the anti-terrorist branch. And during the 70s, they assisted the campaign against the IRA, and they worked alongside what was known as Special Branch and obviously MI5, the security services. What you have now is the Met's got the Counter-Terrorism Command, which is known as CTC. And that actually came about as a result of the Anti-Terrorist Branch and Specialist Branch for amalgamating as one unit in 2006. So that kind of brought their intelligence operations, investigative functions into sort of one single command. I think now they have about well over 1,500 police officers and staff, and they have specialist units that have a capability to respond and proactively and reactively around the world.
Well, let's bring in a man with first-hand knowledge of investigating acts of terrorism, former member of the anti-terrorism branch, David Alexander. Welcome, David.
Good morning.
David, I think I'm right in saying that you and Kaz knew each other in the early days of the force. Is that right?
Yeah, I think my first memories of Kaz were way back in about 1980-something, early 80s. Young in service on the crime squad, looking to make our way into the CID, as I recall, Kaz. So, yeah, we bumped into each other then and sort of bumped into each other over the years, ever since, really. So, yeah, known each other a long time in that respect.
You just said you were with Kaz trying to get into CID. How did you move into anti-terrorism from there?
And the basic process with any move into specialist operations, which is what SO13 was, you apply. They want staff to go in and work with them, so you apply for a position, and that's really what I did.
So what? Sorry, could you just clarify what's SO13?
SO13 was the anti-terrorist branch when I joined, which is now counter-terrorism command. But SO13, the anti-terrorist branch.
Okay, and so was SO13 very much separate from the rest of the force?
It was part of specialist operations. So there were several different parts of what they termed SO, specialist operations. And SO13 was one aspect of that. The firearms team was another part of SO. Special branch was a part of SO, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of different aspects to it. SO13's role and remit was the investigation of terrorist activities within, and at that time, within London, and also the rest of the country.
Okay. And, what were your main threats back then? What were the main threats you were dealing with back then?
Mainly, it was dealing with the IRA threat, the fact that there were numerous bombings and incidents involving the IRA, which ranged from quite simple incendiary devices that were placed in shops or shopping malls where they would cause a fire when everywhere was shut down, so overnight on a small timing device, ranging right up to very large lorry bombs containing 2 or 3 tons of an explosive mixture. So mainly IRA. There was domestic terrorism, as it was called. So something like animal rights, there were incidents with those, mainly around petrol-type devices that were used to burn lorries belonging to people who transported animals to abattoirs, that sort of thing. But yeah, the main thrust definitely was around Irish, or what was termed Irish terrorism at that time.
So in those days, how did you approach a blast scene? If we can sort of take a hypothetical here, you've got a bomb going off in London, sort of Canary Wharf style. How would you approach that scene?
Okay, right. Well, after the initial influx of officers who would go in there, their priority is to save life. So if there were injuries and victims that were walking wounded, their main priority would be to go in and help them. So you'd have the police, the fire service, ambulance service, they would all be there in the scene doing what they must do to preserve life. That's the paramount importance. So as officers of the anti-terrorist branch, we would be deployed to go in, and our role would be to investigate the cause of that devastation, identify what had happened, and try and recover evidence to prove, A, that there had been an explosive had caused it, because we need that evidence to charge people against terrorism acts, and recover other forensic evidence from within the scene. And if there are fatalities, then we would be responsible for the recovery of the fatalities. And there's stages in which we would do that, which we all refer to as our search stages. And it's quite simple, really. Priority would be recovery of the victims who have lost their life. So that's bodies and body parts, if it was disrupted bodies. And there's a system that we use to do that. And this is where it can get quite a bit involved. But although that would be our priority, what we're loath to do is step over other evidence to get to the victims. So once we know that we can get into that scene, it's under our control, we've got to consider also, are there other persons out there that are going to do or commit another offence? Do we need to try and find out who they may be? Is there evidence in there that can get the investigating team out to try and stop potentially another attack? So although our priority is recovery of the bodies, we've got to consider that aspect as we approach each body or body part. So it can be a very slow process. I mean, if you look at, I suppose, the most one that everyone will recall is the London bombings. The officers in those scenes, it took days to get to the victims, all of them out of there. It wasn't done in 10 minutes. It's a long process. And they have to be recovered forensically. They have to be photographed. Every stage of the recovery of the body is photographed. And although it sounds horrible, but we have to preserve the body by wrapping them. Cass will tell you that any murder scene, you need to put the body into a body sheet or a body bag to take it to the mortuary for further examination. And that's exactly the same as we do there. But we need to protect the body as much as possible to keep any contamination of that body intact. We don't want cross-contamination issues within the scene.
David, can I ask you something? What is actually your priority, yours alone, that you work with a team, but what is yours absolutely that you do as soon as you're tipped off there's a bomb, Good Street Station?
Well, as soon as we're tipped off about that, we will be on a standby until something happens. We were very much a reactive team. So the first person we would get to go to that scene, if there was a call to say that there was a bomb there that's going to explode and it hasn't yet exploded, it would be the role of the local uniform officers to identify where that device is as best as they can, try and get a description of where it is and what it looks like, and then they would have to put in cordons if they were satisfied it was a real threat. So depending on the size of the device, if it's a rucksack, you're talking a minimum of 100 metres of cordon area around that rucksack if it's suspected to contain an explosive device.
So is a bomb disposal expert different from what you're doing?
A bomb disposal expert is a military, ex-military person in London. It's military personnel outside of London, and they are trained explosive ordnance disposal officers from within the military. All of them are.
So you would not, your team would not actually be there to check the if a bomb has not exploded. You bring in that other section to it.
The explosive officer has got to be the first person to go in there, yeah, definitely. Wow. They've got to examine that device. If it's not gone off, their role will be to approach that device if they feel confident enough. And there's a lot of questions that have to be asked about that before, obviously, because they're not going to just walk up to something without knowing a little bit about it. Although, having said that, they do sometimes, but that's another story. But they will go down there where they can, and they will, where it's possible, and if they think it's doable, they will try to make that device safe. Now, there's a number of ways they can do that. They can either, if they feel confident enough with what they're looking at, do that so that it's still intact. And I'll simplify this by saying what you would probably say in a film or a book, they cut the right wire, okay? It's a lot more involved in that. Yeah. They will make that device safe. And we've recovered in that respect. Then that's what our team would do, my team would do, as the exhibits officer stroke scene examiner. We would then go in. We'd have a briefing from the explosive officer of what they have found, what they have done, so that we know it was safe. And then we're told it's safe to do the recovery. And then we will forensically recover that item and all the bits concerned with it. The other alternative for the explosive officer is if they don't consider it safe to do that procedure, they will do what they call a make safe explosion. So they will actually detonate the device and disrupted if possible. So when I say detonated, they'll target it in a specific way to try and stop the device from actually exploding. And if that's successful, then we'll get a few bits back from that device, which is still a very, very good recovery from an evidential perspective.
So, for example, David, if the device and somebody from the public has called in to say there's a suitcase left on the platform, that it's been there for 2 hours, that's the first indication something may be wrong. But it's like that suitcase, who handles, if they've got the suitcase, they've detonated the bomb, that suitcase, which department will then be given that suitcase to say, okay, what are you going to get, bring to us from that suitcase, where it was made, any fingerprints on it? Is that, I'm just trying to fathom out the dividing teams that are in the process of working in terrorism.
Yeah, right. Okay. So there is a device in it, but it's been made safe.
Yes.
Right. In that aspect, the SO13 forensic team, exhibit officer, would go down there and they would take possession of that suitcase and its content and be advised by the forensic explosive scientists who work down at the, what these termed FEL. Have you heard of?
Yes.
Yeah. So they would be the ones that we would seek advice from regarding how would you prefer this to be packaged? How do you want us to present this to you? If it's safe, we could literally package the whole suitcase up and take it to the forensic explosives laboratory. So we've recovered it. We've tried to do that in a forensically clean way so that we've not contaminated it. We've not interfered with any fingerprints, DNA, fiber evidence, whatever evidence potentially could be obtained from that suitcase. We will recover that and submit it to the laboratory, and then they can do their examination to identify how the device would have worked had it functioned or if it had not been made safe. And that's their role.
Have you ever been involved in a case where one of the injured was in actual fact one of the terrorists?
Now you're talking about an own goal.
Yes.
In effect.
Yes.
I personally haven't dealt with one of those, but I am aware of one. If you recall the Aldwych bus.
Yes.
Right. Well, that was a device that exploded before it should have done, and the person who had control of that device died at that scene.
I love that expression, an own goal.
Sorry, yeah, I know. I don't wish to sound blase about these terms.
David, if we go back to the scene itself, if the devices exploded, you know, if we look at the sort of evidence you're looking for, how much can you tell about the device? Because that's got to be sort of a key component of your investigation quite early on, is trying to find out what sort of device it was and find as many elements of it. Just talk me through when you can start to tell what sort of device it was, how far evidence is thrown in a big device. You're saying you've got 100 meters, did you, of cordoned off?
That's a minimum distance for a small device. If you've got a large lorry bomb, such as you mentioned Canary Wharf, they suggest, and this is very easy to say but very difficult to implement, a large vehicle bomb such as that, they talk around, you should have a minimum of 400-meter cordon. You can't imagine the difficulties of placing that in a city of London, Birmingham, Manchester. It's enormously difficult to do that and control. But there are contingency plans in place so that large buildings in those sort of areas do have a reaction plan to deal with evacuation. Now again, if you go back to the days of issues with the IRA, for example, they generally would give you a phoned warning that something had been placed and where it was and a rough time of when that device might explode. It wasn't always accurate. But it was a warning, and we sometimes were managed in that case to get the evacuations implemented. Canary Wharf was a huge blast, and only two people actually died from that, and they were warned to leave, and they were about to leave, but they wanted to shut their shop first, and unfortunately the device exploded before they left. There were other people injured, but in the main, apart from the sad deaths for those two people, the main problem or the main damage was to the buildings, millions and millions of pounds worth. But to go into that scene, once it's been declared explosively safe by our explosive officers, those, you know, wonderful guys who I've got enormous respect for, and they've had a look initially to say, well, I've been in there, this is where the device was, this is the seat of the device. Not difficult if it's a large vehicle bomb, because there'll be a crater there about 20 foot deep and 30 or 40 feet wide. And I can say, this is the explosive officer, he could tell us roughly what he thought the size of the device was, what the direction of blast most likely was, which give us a clue as to where we may find most of the bits we'd be looking for. And because of their experience, they would be able to perhaps give us an indication of what we would need to be looking for. And obviously, the more of these types of explosive scenes you go to, you get a better idea of what you can expect to find. So our approach to that scene would be initially to gather what I would call our quick wins. So things that are obviously there, I can see them, I know they're part of the device, or they've been very, very close to the seat of that explosion where it detonated, and I can pick those up very quickly and get those into the system for examination to assist in the identification further by the forensic explosive laboratory. And then from that stage, we'll do what I call a walkthrough search. And we would do a walkthrough search, and we would be looking to pick up different materials connected with the device. So, for example, we'd have bags of nylon, which we would put in different types of material in each bag. So metal, plastic, wood, that sort of thing. And we'd have in each zone a selection of debris which we've identified as potentially coming from that device. Okay, so that's the first phase after we got the quick wins, the walkthrough. If necessary, we'd then do exactly the same thing but a fingertip search. So we'd have the officers down on their hands and knees, and we'd be going through and we'd be identifying and packaging items in a similar fashion. If we see what we call significant items, items that we can identify as being part of the device. A bit more difficult in a lorry bomb, but a suitcase or a rucksack, there could be a timing device in there, such as a mobile phone, circuit board, SIM cards could be found, that sort of thing, which could be quite significant to the investigation. They would all be photographed in situ. They would then be packaged individually and exhibited as an individual item rather than as part of a bigger pile of debris, if you like.
That's so fascinating. So if we take 7-7 as an example, how much evidence and what sort of evidence did you manage to gather from these various stages of the search process?
Okay, well, within 7-7 scenes, and there, bear in mind there were four of them, so there was differences within the scenes in how they were found, but there was parts of a rucksack found. To explain how we know how important that rucksack was, there were survivors, obviously, within the where the bomb blast took place. So that rucksack and the bits and pieces, as I said, you can quite significant what you see in the materials that you recover that tells us that that has been very close to the seat of the detonation of the device. So the effect it has on the material. So that is very important for us to find as well. Having found those bits of the rucksack, that tied in with witness evidence that we subsequently got from survivors who told us what they'd seen. If you remember, the fourth device was on the bus at Tavistock. That was a delay in that actually going exploding, because he had come out of the tube station and had gone to the bus. But before that, we captured him very quickly on CCTV, carrying, again, a very similar or same rucksack. So we've got a good description of what he was carrying at that time, and that tied in very much with it. So from that, we've got an identification of the rucksack. There was identification found, which related to names of people who, when searched on the intelligence cells, flagged up as being of interest. There were parts of the container within the rucksack. So the device consisted of a rucksack. Inside that was a plastic container. Inside that was the explosive charge. And the timer was, in fact, the actual bomber. They just had some wires going up from a switch, which they activated the bomb with. So from that and from the ID, and with all the other intelligence that was coming in, the information from members of the public. Members of the public had phoned in about four people who had parked a car at a railway station in Luton. And that came into play as well. So officers were deployed there, and the explosive officer there, when he opened it up, found remaining devices and explosives within that vehicle. So we've got a whole vehicle containing devices. We've got parts of the rucksack in the bomb scenes, and we've got details of the vehicle. All this building up. As I say, the scenes are just one part, one cog in a very giant wheel, and we're one part of it. The rest of the command was moving off on the investigation side, looking into all this intelligence that was coming in, and that very quickly with the use of, we've got the vehicle, AMPR. Where did the vehicle come from? We got the route from London to Luton, from Leeds, track that all the way back virtually to the very address where they were staying. So it was ever so simple, although intense, in recovering that intelligence and that information.
That's so interesting, David. If we look at the investigation and where it goes from there, I mean, ultimately, I know it must change from the IRA to, say, a modern suicide bomber, but essentially your investigation is looking to find evidence of what the bomb was and then where the bomb was made?
Or who made it, yes, definitely. You look to try and find that. The links are important. I mean, we can't prove that from the scene, but what we can prove is we've got these devices, this part of the device, and that was part of it. So if we then get, for example, the time and power unit, the suicide bombers was different altogether, but there was other aspects of that which we could investigate. If we get part of that, we can then identify who's responsible. If you find the safe house or the factory where they made those devices, then, of course, you can start comparing forensically what was found at the scene with what was found at the safe house. It's basic forensic comparisons that will take place then.
Obviously, David, you worked on 7-7. I know that you went to, or you were part of the team that followed up on the finding of the bomb factory. In that case, can you tell us about that?
When I got deployed to Leeds, that was about 4 days, 5 days later, and I was told, "You got your overnight bag. Can you get your way up to Leeds now? Go to a certain police station and wait there, and we'll be in touch." So I got my little bag for the overnight stays, as they call them, and I went up to Leeds, and I was there for 6 weeks. I actually checked out my hotel 3 times, and before I got to the car, I was told, "No, go back, book in. We've got something else to do now." So it was a long 6 weeks up there, and it was to do with the bomb factory. Ultimately, it was found in Alexander Grove.
What was found at the address? I mean, what was it like in a bomb factory? What's it look like in there?
Within the premises, the mixture they were making was a peroxide-based explosive, and the detonators they used to detonate that main charge were what we call PATP, which was, again, a very dangerous mixture. But the manufacturing process, this is why they had to wear masks. It causes like a vapour, which then, as it solidifies again, it will fall onto the floor in very, very small crystal sort of forms. So they're quite hard. But it was found, and we had experienced this once before years ago, but it was found that when you walk on these things, they actually go pop because they're exploding under your feet. It's like a Rice Krispie going. If you turn on a Rice Krispie, you get that snap. And this is what was found on the premises, on the floor, within that house where all this flat, where you go in, and as you walk in, the guys were going pop, 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 which was quite disconcerting.
It's amazing. It's a bit more snap, crackle and pop than you want, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but a lot of stuff was, I think there was a good couple of 100 grams of crystals were recovered, which is a lot. Bearing in mind, you know, a very small amount of that will do you a great deal of harm. You lose certainly fingers or a hand if you're not careful.
You hear about bomb factories, like in a lot of these cases, without sort of, you know, making it this an advertisement for making a bomb. How easy is it to make a bomb?
Basic bombs are not difficult at all, but you can get a lot of information on the internet these days. I wouldn't suggest it, but Google it and you'll see that you get thousands of hits, and it ranges from the simple devices such as a petrol bomb, pipe bomb, upwards. I think the last time I looked, which was many years ago, there was even some suggestion there of how you could make your own nuclear device if you had the material. So it's frightening. It's quite scary what's out there that people can get action to.
Terrifying. It feels frequently like the thing that keeps us safe, apart from good investigation, obviously, is the fact that they don't always go off. Like there was Putney Bridge not long ago, and it seems to be more difficult to successfully detonate one than it looks or sounds on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to add on. I mean, the good thing about it is in the wake of what happened at 7/7 and indeed 21/7, there was this concerted effort to reduce the availability of the materials required to make specifically peroxide-based explosives. The strengths, you could buy them in a chemist, simple things that had peroxide in them for women's hair or gent's hair for that matter, and nail cleaning and that sort of stuff all contained peroxide, and the strengths were quite high. So they've now reduced that down considerably, which makes it even more difficult for these types of devices to be manufactured. So that's probably why you haven't seen them. 21/7, that was slightly different insofar as there were two different mixtures. There was no, as far as I'm aware, there was no link found between 7/7 and 21/7. They were two separate types of device using a different mixture. The difference was that 7/7, they got the mixture right using what they used. 21/7, they didn't. But the detonator went off, but the main charge didn't. And I'm not an explosive officer, so I won't go into too much detail. But basically, it's simple. You've got a primary explosive, and you've got a secondary explosive. The secondary is normally the main charge. You need a primary explosive to make that go bang. That gives you the kick. The detonator is what we call the primary explosive. That gives you the kick to cause the explosion of the main charge. And although the detonator worked, the main charge didn't have the right mix. But that brought its own problems on 21/7, because the reaction was that you've got the whole device was left there on the buses or on the floor of where they were, and that was just like a wet mass, and that actually started to bubble and smoke. So with the guys who dealt with that, a very close friend of mine, he said we just didn't know what the hell we had, and nor did the explosive officers. So that's quite worrying as well. How do you deal with something when you don't know what it is?
And does that bring in the wider police force? I mean, is there a role, Kaz, for the rest of the police force when you're maybe you're hunting for somebody who got away, or you're going to secure the bomb factory? Are these areas where the rest of the police force are called upon?
Not really, other than, I mean, the anti-terrorists would obviously call in firearms units if they're going to do a hit on a house. But no, it didn't really involve in us at all. I mean, the only time I ever got involved with SO13 was during the, I think it was the early, mid-90s, when there was a campaign starting again, and some of us from murder squads were seconded to the branch to help do some of the inquiries from phone calls that came in from members of the public. And the only time again was with 7/7 bombings. I worked in the mortuary as a CSI, working alongside pathologists and organising teams to identify the deceased. But actually, within that, picking up what Dave said about looking for parts of bombs in the mortuary, we had state of the art X-ray equipment, scanners. So everybody and body part is checked for any bits and pieces that may possibly be from an explosive device. And then that can be separately packaged. But of course, as you can imagine, in a tube station or a bus, you've got lots of wires. So, you know, it must be painstaking for the experts to work out what's what. I also remember Dave might tell you what it's going to Fort Holston years ago, and all the bits of a vehicle that exploded were swept up and taken down there and put on a conveyor belt where people sat and watched the bits go by and were, again, looking for bits of explosive material. And they actually I think it was the Docklands bombing? They rebuilt the truck that had exploded as best as they could. It was, I mean, just amazing.
The thought that after a bomb, you know, Canary Wharf, the amount of debris, do you remember the key piece that was actually presented as this is what happened, this is where it came from? Do you remember that?
From memory, I believe they found part of what they were using as a timing device in those days, which was called a memo park timer. Now that would be, I don't know if you remember these things, but you could buy them and it was to remind you of when you put your money in the parking meter that you'd set it for an hour and it would go round, make a noise to tell you your time's up on the parking meter. Well, they were an integral part of the IRA devices at that time and were part of what they called the time and power unit. And that is something that if you found one of those in any scene, that was almost as good as a fingerprint to say that's been made by the IRA. So we knew who was responsible, regardless of whether they claimed it or not. We've still got to prove it, of course. So something like that would be found. And that was found, I'm pretty sure that was found at Canary Wharf. If I'm wrong, I apologise. But I know it's something we always looked for, was that time and power unit.
Yeah. This series of Listening to the Dead is Cause of Death. It occurs to me that perhaps we don't actually know, I don't maybe understand what causes the death in a blast like this. Are you, you know, in terms of physiology, are you actually dying because of a brain injury or loss of blood? Or what is the general cause of death when you've got a bomb going off?
I think that depends on the injuries you receive. I mean, you can find someone who's died at the scene who has got no physical obvious injuries on the outside, but they've been killed by the shockwave. You know, it can just shatter you or your vital organs. And on the other hand, you've got someone who, you know, poor soul may have lost both legs and they've just bled to death before anyone could get there to help them. I do remember 1 year ago there was a bomb incident in London. I won't go into the detail because it's not fair of survivors there, but there was one piece of shrapnel that hit one person in the neck and they died instantly. And yet the person standing next to them walked away with, you know, bad eardrums and that sort of thing. So it's not specific upon blast. It can be anything. And if I could just add on to that very quickly, it's the fact that no two bomb scenes are ever the same. Whatever you deal with, it's going to have a different reaction or action. If you literally made two devices which are identical and put them in two places, you're not going to find the stuff in exactly the same place each time. It's going to go all over the place. It'll have a different reaction. It'll have a different effect.
Interestingly, on that, picking up on that, from my viewpoint of working in the mortuary, one of the things was you didn't know who any of those people were. In a murder, generally, you know who your victim is pretty quickly. It's quite different when you're dealing, I found, when you're dealing with something and you don't know anybody, and then a few days later, you see a picture in a paper, and it's that person graduating from university, and you recognise the face, and that's how they're identified. And I found that quite moving, because it was very different from what I was used to dealing with at murder scenes. And it can be a long process because, as Dave said, it's not just whole bodies you're dealing with, it's body parts. And the families expect us to recover as much of their lost one as we possibly can.
David, you were very much involved in the war crimes in Kosovo. And is there a difference and a different approach from working on war crimes to working on the IRA? Is that noted as a war crime, or is it a terrorist? Are they two different things? You see what I mean?
I do. I mean, my opinion on that is that it's two separate entities entirely. You've got the terrorist aspect, which are looking at, obviously, causing as much destruction and devastation as they can at that time in the 80s around London and outside of London. The war crimes, as far as Kosovo is concerned anyway, it was very much a political thing where we were sent over to investigate the atrocities that happened in that war. So it was more from when I was out there, and there were teams sent out over a period of time. But I was one of the later teams to go out there, and we were doing mainly exhumations to establish causes of death and prove that war crimes had been committed, and then helping with identification of those victims to repatriate them back to the families. So it was a different type of investigation in that respect. We weren't, or certainly my role in that was not investigating the actual crimes that had taken place. It was proving that they had occurred, if that makes sense.
So you didn't have to deal with a kind of public panic. That was actually almost the aftermath, which was you proving, as you just said, how death occurred.
Yeah.
Where the body is very much in decomposition, obviously there had to be a lot of that. It must have been a vast amount of work to do.
Yes, it was. As I said, I wasn't the only person that went out there. There were different teams doing different areas within Kosovo. We were on what was termed the British forensic team, which strangely enough consisted of us working within what was then the German sector, but we had Russian military as our support stroke protection whilst we were in those areas. But the team consisted of myself, DVI trained body recovery people, an anthropologist. And the mortuary was set up where we were working, just outside of a place called Prizren, was set up in an old garage. So the conditions were pretty harsh. It wasn't nice and clean, shall we say. And the recovery of the bodies was, it wasn't the nicest thing I've ever had to do, let's put it that way.
Were they both male, female and children?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And it wasn't always just what you would think of execution style, where they may have been shot. It was also, there was one which still sticks with me now, where they put a family into a house and basically set it on fire and then thrown tyres into the house so that it smouldered for longer, which in effect meant that the bodies were, you were never going to recover whole bodies or any bits of them, just maybe some bones and bone fragments, which is all we really recovered from that particular scene. So it was quite quite vicious what went on out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's very true and very sad. But a fascinating chat. David, thank you so much for sharing your remarkable career with us.
Thank you, David.
That's it for this episode. Thanks to David Alexander, Linda and Kaz. We'll be back next week. Here's a clip.
Measuring the dimensions of the entry wound together with an examination of the wound track and its associated damage through the body, that can give us quite a lot of information as to the weapon type used.
If you haven't done so already, then please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now. And new episodes will automatically appear in your feed. Otherwise, do check out Linda's website, lindalaplante.com, for more details about past and future episodes. Linda's book, Blunt Force, is out now in all formats, and her next book, Judas Horse, is available for pre-order. Until next week, goodbye. Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books UK.
CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event. Get inside the mind of serial killers and psychopaths. Learn from leading criminologists. Hear from the families and survivors. Meet your favorite true crime podcasters. Immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. CrimeCon is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered by Crime and Investigation. I will be there, as will Cass, so come and join us. Quote Bonnier, that is B-O-N-N-I-E-R, to claim a 10% discount. Limited tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit crimecon.co.uk. See you there!